Guy, Steve, thank you for coming. There is, I think, as always, a frustration from Sea because they never really get the story of what's going on and what people are trying to do on their behalf. So thank you for coming today. And I just wonder if you could perhaps give them a little bit of a flavour of what it is that you've been trying to do for them and battling against the odds, may I say.
Thanks, Albert. Maybe just start on that, but it seems such a long time ago, but I remember back in January 2020 when it started to kick off and we had China effectively shut down, I think if you remember. We had ships stuck in dry docks, we had ships stuck at anchor, couldn't be able to get in and out, and really starting to get the real issues with the crew. We were starting to get very concerned about our seafarers, and at that point, we started developing medical guidelines and how to deal with it all. And then, of course, roll on a couple of months. I remember actually going to the WHO in February 2020 as well, and it still seemed a bit far off of a global pandemic. And then, of course, March hit us, and it was like a train crash. Suddenly, the world stopped, and I think that's when Steve and I just picked up the phone to each other. And we said, we've got to do something about this. We cannot let all any divisions in the past have to be put aside, and we have to work collectively together to try and deal with this, because suddenly crews couldn't change. And governments appear to be oblivious to our pleas, really, to keep the world supply chains going. And I think working collaboratively with the ITF and with many other partners, including IFSMA as well, we put in place a detailed set of protocols which in order to keep our crew safe and to persuade governments that it was okay for transport workers to cross international borders and serve on board the ships. And they were issued to governments as back as we had them in place by May. We were lobbying hard again for a crew to be relieved, to no avail. I've got friends who are at sea, stuck on board ships as well, so I was getting plenty of messages from them at the same time as well. But I think one thing that was heartening was just the level of cooperation between international partners, not just the ITF, not just the ICS, but also IFSMA, but also the IMO, the International Labour Organization. We're having calls 2-3 times, 4 times a week to try and resolve the issues. We worked really hard together. And I think over the months that followed, it's slowly but things, I think Hans, you said it, is that we may perhaps stabilise, if not improve the situation, by working together. At one point we had over 400,000 seafarers well beyond their contract length, and those numbers have slowly come down over time, but the problem hasn't gone away. We've got real issues, and I think I would just say that we're seeing what we warned about last year is starting to come to fruition, with supply chains actually fracturing now, and people can't get hold of the goods, and suddenly transport workers are important. Yeah. And I think that's, perhaps it's economic self-interest as opposed to humanitarian oversight that's enabled that to happen. But it really has highlighted just how essential crew are and seafarers are, and also transport workers in general. Yeah. And, 2 or 3 months ago, we joined forces with the IATA, the airline group, and also the International Road Haulage Union, to do a sort of joint campaign as well on transport workers, which is... hopefully starting to resonate. Certainly done a lot of media and stuff like that as well. Of course, vaccinations have been an issue. We've developed, with ITF, a roadmap on vaccinations, how they can be administered. We've been campaigning very hard to get as many seafarers vaccinated. We have had some progress, particularly in the United States, when they opened up for overseas seafarers, and that was followed suit by Europe. It was still probably only about 30% of our seafarers fully vaccinated, so there's a huge number still to go. So we're lobbying still very hard for vaccination hubs, for supplies from the COVAX programme to be made available to transport workers. All these things are happening behind the scenes. Sometimes you don't always see these things on the ground, but I can assure you the huge volume of work that is being done and the cooperation being done to persuade governments that they need to take our needs seriously if we're going to have, quite frankly, presents under the tree at Christmas as much as anything. So just some key dates, and in July 2020, we managed to persuade the UK government to hold a ministerial summit. That was actually quite a game changer. We did get some governments signing up to give key worker status to seafarers. In December, we had the UN General Assembly. We also had a sort of written resolution from the International Labour Organization into basically calling out governments for failing to act under their international obligations under the Maritime Labour Convention, the Committee of Experts there. And we've really just used every tool in our box. I don't think shipping itself has been as much in the media as it is at the moment. And I think that's probably a good thing going forward. So I think it's been an incredibly busy year. It hasn't stopped. And I want to assure your members that we'll never stop until we've got full and total resolution of the issues which are facing us. But I have to say, the cooperation we've had with ITF bodes well, I think, for the future when we start moving on to the next big challenge, which is going to be the decarbonisation of our industry and the moving to alternative fuels. So it's let's hope that the foundation stones that we've built over the last 18 months can be used to really good effect for that, to ensure a just transition now to a new industry, as what we're calling the fourth propulsion revolution, as that starts to bite. So perhaps I'll leave it there for the time being, and perhaps go over to Steve.
Well, Steve, I was just interested, I mean, I think from my perspective, to see the relationship between the ITF and the ICS, which is primarily you and Guy. Could you perhaps, from your point of view, just sort of elaborate on that a little bit of where you, in some of the key issues that you've been and some of the thought processes which you as a union, an international union, perhaps have gone through on some of the things which you might or could have done to see whether it could have had an impact on raising awareness of shipping, and in particular the relationship that we have or you have had with the IMO and the ILO, because I've explained to our members that the IMO and the ILO is of course the nations and those delegates that take part in it, but everybody forgets about the work that the secretariats do, and perhaps you could elaborate on that a bit.
Well, thanks Jim and thanks Guy. First I should welcome Jim and the team to ITF House, so it's an absolute pleasure for them to be here, and hopefully you can see that we're right at the end of the table and the screen's not too bad. So we're very proud to have them here, and I think some of that is because of the relationship that's been fostered. There's many familiar faces, Roger, Hans, my friend Marcos, many of you on the screen who I know personally and consider friends. So I think as the ITF family, wherever you fit in the maritime world, this is a crucial partnership. Now, to go to that point about maybe what's different, so I suppose I have to tell you what life was like before, Guy. I have to be a bit careful how I put some of that. The reality is ICS is a very, very good professional organisation, so I'm not going to disagree with that. But as you saw from your promotional video, ISMA and ITF are very, and Marcos is a long representative of the ITF at the IMO. And I think we've kind of limited ourselves to technical space. And right now, COVID's highlighted quite how critical it is for us to be in political space. So Jim, the conversation about partnership, it was there, but I think it was more like technical counterparts. You mentioned the ILO, and I'll say this, and I probably will flip around in different transport sectors just to give you a little bit of a concept of what was going on in other parts of the ITF, roughly 18 million transport workers globally. But maritime is quite unique, and I will say special, and in a special place in the ITF's heart, so to speak, because the authority we have at the ILO, and the authority I say we have, it's not just the ITF, that's the Maritime Partners and the Maritime Labour Convention, is world leading. And I don't want you to underestimate quite how difficult it is to move the world's UN agencies. That's one thing I will talk about before I finish my presentation, how frustrating it can be. But the reality is, the ITF and the ICF have set strong foundations in the ILO with the Maritime Labour Convention. It is their secretariat's most powerful convention. And that takes us to the question about, did we stick by it? So the reality, and Guy touched the sort of crisis mentality. So him and I reaching out for each other, which again, I give him and his leadership immense credit for, was to say, look, this is a proper crisis. This isn't an industrial or a technical issue. This is an issue about humanity and welfare. So we basically started from that position, Jim, and everybody in the ITF team, Jackie, all of our colleagues, everybody around the world was scrambling for leadership. And leadership in a moment of crisis is either there or isn't there, let's put it that way. And I found it an absolute pleasure. And you know, look, no one can work collaboratively without the fundamental ingredients of trust and confidence. So through this process, we've worked with Guy, and I'll also say Jim has been added to the flavour of, and that doesn't mean we haven't had good relationships with your organisation before, but has added to the different views, and certainly in the different crises at the moment, which I think is what Jim wants me to focus on a little bit, has added your voice, the master's voice, into the debate about responsibility for your ships and your crew. So for us in the ITF, we've had to look at it in a different way. We have probably, and Hans is on here and Marcos, our traditions in the seafaring section are to have partnerships with ship owners. And you know, and we say it, and today I think the numbers are the worst they've ever been. 85 ships were abandoned in 2020. We highlight the bad actors, but that means, and similar to what Guy was saying, you don't see all the good work that goes on 90% of the time. And that's been amplified by this whole process. So we in the ITF, we struggled with the lack of respect that was shown towards seafarers. And in consultation with Guy, and again, sometimes it wasn't like we were on different organisations, it was like we were on the same team trying to strategize about what would be the most effective outcome. And so that was a question. What can we ask masters to do with their legal authority? What, you know, we went out with Enough is Enough just before that, in June last year, and we got absolutely hammered by many of the ship owners that we have good relationships with, because they were saying, no, you can't do that, it's irresponsible, we made the situation worse. But it was a reflection of the frustration of the seafarers through to our leaders that no one was listening. And around that time, we were approaching the 400,000 mark. That's 400,000 seafarers over contract, and 400,000 seafarers mostly only paid when they're on board, waiting for their new jobs. So that's a significant part of the 1.7 million population of seafarers. So for us, it was, how do we deal with this? And in a way, we kind of peeled off positions and bargained down, because ultimately many of the ship owners that we do deal with were unable to get the seafarers off, and we were getting messages directly from their seafarers into our claims team saying, can I get off in India, can I get off in Europe? And actually at certain peak moments they couldn't get off. I had them saying, we want to get off in Algeria, and we had to help with the Algerian immigration authorities. So there was a moment in time when the ILO, again, close collaboration with their secretariats, and I would say both IMO and ILO secretariats, couldn't have done more in their current status, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But the reality was that we had to work with the ship owners. You know, we had ship owners flying Indian crew via Doha on chartered flights in and out just to get them moving. We wrote to the Philippines government jointly, asking them to put more flights into the Philippines. Our friends in AMASUP know that very well. We couldn't get them to agree because they were managing. So I think the one big thing that I want us to think about in all of our relationships as we go forward is, for me, transport workers across the whole supply chain, whether you work in a warehouse, if you're in the UK at the moment and you go to a supermarket and it's a little bit empty, it's because there's not enough truck drivers, were not respected before COVID. The fact that they moved the food, the personal protection equipment, medical equipment, dare I say vaccines if they're flying them around, has highlighted the importance of transport workers and the supply chains, which you're all very much part of, but hasn't given us the authority. So the big challenge for us is to take this profile and convince national governments of the importance of shipping and the importance of the transport supply chains that deliver our everyday lives. So for us in the ITF, it's looking actually not just sector by sector, it's joining up the sectors. And what I mentioned, unheard of reaching out for IATA, which is the Civil Aviation Employers, IRU, which is the National Truck Owners Associations, and all four of us letting rip, shall I say, at governments for their irresponsibility. Now, you know, we wouldn't be good trade unionists. That's probably a little bit different from some of the rest of the conversation if we weren't screaming and shouting about some of these issues. But what we have to do is take the learning experiences from this, and we have to take the camaraderie and confidence and trust. And Guy mentioned it, and we probably should let you ask some questions, but we do want to talk about vaccines, into this next space. Because if this pandemic was life-changing, which I believe it has been for our societies, the big challenge now is, what is the future under climate and the restrictions that are going to come in across all of our transport modes, and therefore all of the skills that the working men and women, and not enough women in maritime, that we have to represent. So the challenge for us is taking what we've learned, recognising the fragile nature. Can I say we've had our 3 minutes of fame, and now we need to capitalise that and turn it into a full hour series with strategies underpinning why we keep the world moving, whichever part of the table we sit. And frankly, we're all sitting around the same table, and if it was round, it would be a bit better. But the reality is, colleagues, it's a privilege to talk to you. We've got lots of things we want to talk about, but Jim probably needs to stop me talking now and share a few more questions. But again, I just want to put on thanks that the way everyone's been responsible. And I think we've really represented your views, the seafarers' views, at the highest levels, all the way up to the Secretary General of the UN, in the most professional fashion, and given a good show of what is the maritime industry.
Thank you. The one point, and I mentioned it to our delegations yesterday, was the role of the IMO and ILO secretariats. And they, I think unfairly, or summarise, do fairly, get a lot of stick, because our seafarers say, well, what do they do for us? And I know that between the two of you and the Secretary General of the IMO, you formed the SCAT, which was the Seafarers Crisis Action Team. Could you perhaps just, Guy, give us a little flavour of what it is that they have been trying to do against the odds?
I think it's the SCAT team have actually been very successful in lots of... You don't always hear about it, because it's a lot of it's kept under the radar, because you have to be quite diplomatic, you have to persuade governments to let somebody off. Mm. But they have been very effective, as long as we get early notification, if getting seafarers repatriated, getting people getting medical treatments, all sorts of manner of things which before we never had to think twice about. I mean, we've had some quite horrendous stories. I mean, we had one which was resolved recently now, you know, a captain who died on board the ship and stayed on board that ship for another 5 months before they could repatriate the body. And the work that went on behind the scenes to make that happen, you know, the trail of calls and things like that, is eventually there's a fair play to the United Arab Emirates, who actually stepped up the plate and allowed the body to be repatriated. And you can imagine the effect of the crew on board the ship. You can imagine the poor family back home not being able to have proper closure. So that's the sort of work that the team has been done. A lot of it is unsung, but it's been a lot of hard yards and lots of sort of call throughout the night and throughout the day, and lots of emails and lobbying being going on to happen. So that's been quite an effective tool. Yeah. And what I would say to any serving masters out there, if you have problems, the earlier you can get in touch, the easier sometimes it becomes in order to deal with it. And I just, before I go on, I just want to pay tribute to your members as well, because the incredible leadership position they've had to be on board a ship. And I wouldn't underestimate that. When you don't know when your crew's going to get, I'm sure the crews are coming up to captains saying, well, what's happening? And having to show that leadership, even though you're probably worried yourself, is I won't underestimate just how hard that can be at times. So I think leadership has been shown throughout this pandemic, and let's just hope we can capitalise on that going forward.
Yes, and I think, you know, to their credit, we were incredibly worried about fatigue in our ships. And safety, and whether that was going to be a real issue. But because of you out there, actually, you've really kept and managed to keep it as safe as you possibly can. So I think that's a nice flavour of what we've been doing. But here we are today. We see improving crew change numbers. As far as we know, we've got nobody who is outside of their 11-month maximum allowed by the MLC. And we've got the vaccine issue. So perhaps you could, Steve, just give us a little flavour of where we are today.
So I think, again, thanks, Jim, and thanks, Guy. I think for us, we've widened the debate a little bit. So we did the collaboration with the other trade employers groups. Yesterday, we went quite hard to Swiss, German, EU, and English governments, because the last 2 days has been a World Trade Organization discussion about the TRIPS waiver, which is the patent that controls the vaccines. And there are kind of three targets, Moderna, Pfizer, and BioNTech, who are being backed up by those governments about not allowing a global rollout. So we've taken a pretty political position to say that this pandemic needs to be beaten globally. We saw 2021 was the year of different variants that have stopped us as the world to be able to move. So we've been quite aggressive. In partnership with everybody, we've been working through the UN Secretary General's office to get to COVAX to, and again, I apologize, but my frustration about some of these bodies is palpable, because they've been very helpful, but you imagine the politics. We've seen it in the global north. Vaccines is a voter's policy, so there's been lots of decisions made around political popularity. The conversation then is about, I think I'm quite well briefed because I had to do this yesterday, but in some parts of the global north, you've got 100% vaccines for every 100 people. For certain parts of the other parts of the world, for example, Africa, you've got three vaccines for 100 people. Now, if we, you know, can manage to get the global north up to 100% within 20 months, at the moment, the COVAX figures to get Africa fully vaccinated is 2024. And that's because they won't expand the waivers and they won't put in place. Make no mistake, it's not simple, right? This is, you need certain kind of glass to carry the vaccine, you need certain kind of medical equipment. So it's not simple, but the reality is, for all of our sake, our position is you have to roll this out on a global level. And if you can't treat it in certain parts of Africa or Asia, it will continue to be migrating and creating new forms. So as a team, we're hoping that under the COVAX rules, you can make an application for humanitarian grounds. We were promised fourth quarter, I think we're in the fourth quarter, that it would all become a lot easier. I'm not quite sure we're seeing that. We've actively encouraged a hub mentality, so we've been in consultation at the highest level in Singapore and Qatar. And Singapore's moved a little bit, but perhaps not far enough to allow joiners to have vaccination from the... Ideally, they want us as the core industry to secure the vaccines, and you can't buy them outside of the COVAX protocols. But we've also been in extensive conversation with the Qataris to use Doha Airport as a vaccine hub, which would be from the Qataris' own allowances of Johnson & Johnson. I think, Jim, looking forward, this is a virus we're going to have to live with. And all of you who've travelled in the maritime industry know that you've had to have yellow fever vaccine certificates. And so for us, it's not unusual. But at the moment, between the politics, and I would argue there's quite a bit, the Americans have come out 100% in support of the waiver. It's kind of Europe, which is kind of the ownership of a number of those pharmaceutical companies, that's resisting. But I genuinely believe we'll need a global solution to the pandemic, and then we'll need a maritime and transport solution. Should I throw the one, well, given such good camaraderie behaviour, should I throw ILO's 185 seafarers document conversation into the mix? Because if we'd have rolled that out and we'd got resolution around that, we maybe already would have had a solution that could have had a seafarers identity document with an addition of information about vaccine, PCR test or whatever the protocols are. So I think the big conversation is, what's it going to look like? We've done so much time in the ITF, I've tried to drag Guy in, but he was far too wise to get sucked into some of it. With these data companies about ID, digital wallets, and goodness knows what else. I still believe at the end that will be part of the solution. You know, for the ITF, we're also keen for civil aviation to get going again. And there's, again, end of 23, 2024, before we get back to 2019 numbers. That's hundreds of thousands of jobs and economies depend around civil aviation. And of course, we're already seeing shortages of good jobs in the supply chain. Mm-hmm. So if we don't have answers, and of course, I think perhaps, I will stop talking, I promise, Jim. If we don't have things to advocate, and I prefer that we all advocate as a partnership, having worked out what we agree on in private, then nobody else is leading. And that's the thing I've taken away from the last 20 months, that we have moved those ILO officers, we have moved those IMO officers, and our teams have collaborated literally on a daily basis, whether it's to move a Van Warten who's been taken off a cruise ship, who's been sitting in Rome with a big sign outside the ship, send me home, for 18 months. It's not his fault. It wasn't the cruise operator's fault. There were no flights to Vanuatu, right? So these are things that hopefully we will record at the end of this process and show what we've done together and use that as a platform to make a significant difference. And as I say, ultimately promote what is an amazing globalised industry.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Guy, I had an interesting question from one of our shipmasters, which was, well, it's really simple. They're generating masses of vaccines. Why don't you just buy them and get the ship owners to give them to us? And on top of that, another one said, well, I've been to three different ports and I've now had to have three different jabs. Why can't you just go out and buy them?
Well, we've tried. Don't believe me. From about January of this year, we've been trying to buy vaccines for the industry. It's not a question of cost for ship owners. I'll tell you, they'd pay it willingly because it's far cheaper than... you know, cost effective, but overall in getting the crew vaccinated, keeping them safe. But you can't buy vaccines directly. You have to. It's down to national governments to do it. We've been lobbying really hard to get access to the COVAX program, which Steve has touched about, but he touched upon. So it's incredibly hard to get them because unless national governments are prepared to give some of their allowance away, then it's not going to happen. And to be fair, that's what we've seen in the United States, we've seen in Europe, is that once they've reached that 100%, they have started to allow overseas seafarers and other transport workers to get the vaccinations. So that's what's the second part of your question was?
One seafarer has been into three different ports.
That's plainly completely and utterly ridiculous. I mean, they must be superhuman, though, if they've got three sets of vaccines. They're probably immune for anything that's thrown at them. But how ridiculous is that? And we have called that out as well. You know, there's no logical reason why that should be the case. And I think my frustration probably is with the World Health Organization, because they haven't stepped up to the plate, in my humble opinion. Mm. How hard can it be to create some sort of international transport vaccine for people to do it? How hard can it actually be? I'm sure they could do it an afternoon if they really put their mind to it.
Yeah, Steve, you want to just...
Well, I just to come in behind that, it's like I've got an example of a seafarer who's had six vaccinations to satisfy six ports or different administrations. And I don't understand, frankly, we're supposed to be representing workers' rights, but we also understand that economics drive the world. So this country here, it changes its rules literally every week, or sometimes three times a week. I can't bring some of my regional secretaries into our EB next week because he had the Sino jab, because that's what the government in Jordan was giving him, right? So how do you move this forward? And I have to come in behind Guy on the W Health Organization, and then I'll say about all of the UN bodies. And I have to be careful, but maybe because they've had a bit of a Trump period where they've been bashed around a bit, they've lost a little bit of their confidence or authority. If we can't rely on the UN system in all of the spaces to deal with all the challenges, then we need to come up with a better way of doing it. Now, for me, I believe they are the right place to do it. They are the right people. We have the professionals. Now we need to get the politics right. And I think that's where I would encourage our partnership to continue to grow, because I believe there's a window of opportunity for, and again, I think it has to be the Global South or the G7 group or the most powerful governments, to actually reflect on how critical shipping is in the middle of a crisis, but how critical shipping will be to respond to the climate challenges. And these are things that, if the agents of authority, the UN bodies, and again, Guy was being very politically correct, literally the teams were meeting every day to encourage governments to let seafarers get off who've had strokes, to let seafarers get off who've got a toothache that could, you know, make them debilitated. And we had to work with the UN agencies. And to be fair, IMO and ILO couldn't have done any more. But that's all a top secret. But the reality is those governments were still going, forget the historical, a seafarer's in danger, you know, the captain's had a stroke. Quick treatment may mean that stroke is not debilitating. Mm. 4 days later of us trying to work out whether we can get him onto an Indonesian island, then the reality will be a problem. So I think the ITF has got a long, long history, and sometimes we've done things overzealously, and sometimes we've done things that, you know, we probably would have to be accountable to captains. I know the ITF inspectors arriving isn't always the favourite moment for everybody, but the reality is when we find the right moments to work as a collaborative campaigning organisation, I think COVID will help us, particularly Guy and I are planning, or he's planning, a very big event, and I've got 3 different modes of transport at COP in Glasgow this year to talk about it. And what are we saying? We're saying it with slightly different shades, but we're saying that the workers and the industry need to be at the table to define what the new regulations are going to be. And it's not just a climate issue, it's a jobs issue, it's a security issue, it's a safety issue. So there's a lot of things that I think this whole process has given us the opportunity to move on, and I'm very proud of that.
I think that's, we've talked, and I think that's given you a really good flavour for what's been going on. Can you just give us a very quick snapshot, Guy, of where we are today with crew changes, numbers, percentage of vaccines for our seafarers?
So we think we're about 30% now of seafarers have been fully vaccinated, so still 70% to go.
Yeah.
We do see progress we made. There's been some small steps forward in Singapore. We'd like for them to have taken much more of a leadership position, if I'm honest. Yeah. But they're starting to get there now, slowly but surely. So that is pretty, but it's still going to take another year or two to get everyone vaccinated. So
and trying to get these decent hubs.
So I suppose the frustration is it's all solvable.
Yeah.
If there's a will to do it. So that's where we are. In terms of crew change numbers that you highlighted as well, we've stabilised it.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in Europe and North America, it is relatively straightforward. Yeah. Relatively, not completely straightforward to do crew changes. It's still a nightmare in the Asia Pacific region.
Yeah.
China is effectively closed to anyone to get crew changes. I think Australia, disappointingly, have taken a very contrary view to all of this.
Mm.
Although been quite happy for the ships to call in to take their exports out.
Yes.
Nonetheless, they haven't exactly covered themselves in glory, in my opinion.
No.
It's just been the fact that's where I think the real our focus is on the moment. If we can try and crack that, and what I was pleased at with Singapore is that they recognise they're going to have to live with the virus. I think you mentioned that, Steve, as well. In which case, we're going to have to slowly get back to some sort of normality and to move it forward. So I don't think we're at the end of the crew change crisis. I think we're stabilised, and all one can hope now is that every month passes, it gets a little bit easier.
Yeah. Thank you. The big issue, I think, and it's something I brought up to our associations yesterday, is what of the future? My view is that many governments around the world have acted in the most appalling way and shown up actually what they really think about their people, and in particular seafarers, and they've treated them with total disregard. My concern is that when things start to get to normal or get back to some sort of form of normality, whatever that might be, those governments who have been the ones who have held back, who have refused to help and have not done this, even though they've signed up to the various resolutions and things which you have managed to get through the ILO and the IMO, is that they'll turn around and say, well, Mr. Cotton and Ms. Guy, you were the doomsayers saying it would all go horribly wrong. Well, actually, it's kept going. So we've vindicated ourselves. We've not had to, you know, spend out a lot of extra effort, and you were wrong. We shouldn't let them forget this, should we? And what are we going to do, and how are you going to take your newfound partnership together in the future?
Well, I think for us, there is this, as I say, short window of opportunity about coalescing a coalition of the willing. So let's assume that exists in this room and on this video call. And then where do we take it? So part of what we're doing, and Guy mentioned the good parts of the vaccine story, but our industry is very dependent on the Philippines, very dependent on Indonesia, and they're struggling to secure, because of financial issues or delay in making the decision, vaccines to get their seafarers. And it took them a while to make the decision that key worker status meant you bumped up seafarer up the right to have. And those are political decisions, never underestimate that. So I think for us, it's a conversation about where can we have the biggest impact. And I think it's been interesting and challenging to have weekly conversations with sort of more of our stakeholders, if that makes sense. So obviously the ITF has ongoing relationships with its ship owner counterparts. Guy has ongoing relationships with his national ship owner associations. But literally we've had tens and hundreds of more players giving their contribution. So I think for us, it's how do we shape the positives of the industry? Mm. How do we promote, just looking at this screen, we are one of the most, just by culture, globalized industries. One of the conversations that perhaps is very difficult for some unions to deal with is career paths in the industry. If we look at the risk that by screaming about the 400,000 seafarers and lack of respect, we cannot lose the attraction of the industry for young people. And again, I think it was the BIMCO study, ICS, that gives me a terrible figure of 1.28 women in the industry, which frankly we should all be ashamed of, because the reality is we have to do much more to make the industry attractive. Now that means maybe we look at, I'm now scared to say what I'm thinking, but let's go for it, radical changing the way you do sea time with a ship, with a shore-based employment capacity. Because, you know, we would say, and we'd say this in all modes of transport, the drive to make transportation so cheap that you look for the cheapest person is not a good sustainable model for an industry. If we want to attract young women and young men to the shipping industry and to the labour movement, so we can help protect them, we have to be able to paint an industry and a decent career in a secure, safe job. And we that's where I would like us to focus some of our attention. I think the climate and the changing alternatives to fossil fuel will give us some new opportunities to explore. I don't believe, and I'm not an expert, I'm rapidly trying to become one, one alternative fuel will be the solution for all of shipping as we know it. And the reality is, we all understand the sophistication of LPG tankers as opposed to a bulk carrier, and the investment in the engine, whatever it's driven by, is quite significantly different. So there's going to be lots of challenges for us. From the ITF view, we want to be sitting next to the guy when he's telling the governments what they need to be doing and why they need to hurry up. But we also want to be relying on you, the seafarers, who have lived and are the ones, and this is the bit where we really have to capture government's imagination. And this is our technical, we have a great group of technical advisors down at the IMO. Anybody, and I haven't, thankfully, who's been on a ship that loses power in the middle of a storm should be part of that argument about what we need to have to make sure this career is safe. But it's also, and I've got some fantastic friends on this call, it also gives you the opportunity to see the best of the world and be part of a global citizen. So these are the things for me, Jim, maybe I'll be a little bit romantic about it, but I want us to take what we've learned through these 20 months, recognise there's very fragile parts of our industry, kind of agree what we need to do to tidy those up, but also tell people about a success story. You know, there's many people on here who are very proud to be mariners and master mariners at that. And that message, you know, I'm not as old as I look, if that's the right way to put it. But I always felt a master mariner used to have a status in our society, and we need to remind everybody why. Because they provide for us,
yeah.
And they are brave every day they go to sea. Yeah. Sorry.
Thank you. Guy, from your perspective at ICS.
Well, I think to Saka what he says, I mean, I worry about the attractiveness of a career at sea, given what's gone on the last 20 months and how we are going to get over that. We've already got a shortfall of officers. It's about 26,000 shortfall at the moment. That's going to increase over the next 3-4 years. So what do we have to do then as an industry to actually persuade young people that it's a career worth following? I mean, you know, I've loved my career. I've been, you know, at sea and ashore. It's been an amazingly rewarding career, the people I've met. And I want young people to understand that actually there's so many career paths you can go down when you get into it. But if we can't persuade them to even join up in the first place, we lose out on that. So that's something we will have to collectively work on. I know, I'm sure many people in the call are sort of ambassadors that way in terms of doing my own daughter's a ship's captain, so I'm very proud that she's followed the family tradition. But we need to persuade lots of young people that it's a career worth following, and that's my concern from the pandemic, is that we're going to be sending the wrong message, and we have to work collectively together to make that happening. And Steve's right, 1.28% of seafarers women is not a good statistic, because partly we're going to be losing out on 50% of the talent as much as anything. So what can we do to change that? Diversity, all these issues, we have to use that cliche, build back better. following the pandemic, to make sure we have build a coalition, so we can seafarers at the heart of that coalition as well, to be able to keep the world moving.
Yeah, thank you. And incidentally, our third paper is going to be on recruitment, retention, and advancement of women on ships and ashore. So quite topical. Thank you both. We've got 15 minutes before Guy and Steve have got to go, because as you hear, they're very busy in what they're doing and their diaries are absolutely maxed out. And I heard a little note from Guy this morning saying, because he's doing face-to-face meetings and remote meetings, one of the things his PA sometimes forget is that he has to move from one to the other. He can't just be in the same place. So he's overbooked on occasions. Now, I know yesterday there were a number of you asked questions, and I said, well, let's save it for our experts for today. So we've got 15 minutes, so please, if you'd like to put your hands up. I know David Appleton from Nautilus, you were quite keen to ask a question. Perhaps you would go first.
Morning all, thanks Jim, and thanks Guy and Steve for your presentation. Yesterday we've been discussing the crew change crisis and also other issues, for example, denial of shore leave, which is quite common in the UK and in other countries. People have given us information on. And all of it, in my opinion, and everything we've discussed over, comes down to where the risk that's been introduced by COVID and the fact that nobody wants to accept that risk and they want to push you off to somewhere else, and that always tends to end up the seafarer at the bottom of the chain. So really, we've got the crew change thing, we've got the shore leave, where, for example, companies are reluctant to allow shore leave for seafarers because they don't want to introduce a risk into their operations, and we even have seafarers that don't want the crew to be allowed ashore because they see it as a risk. And then there's the conversation around vaccines as well, which you touched on. We've had reports of, we have seafarers that are adamant they don't want to have a vaccine. We have seafarers that don't want to work with someone that hasn't had a vaccine. And I understand, obviously, throughout this, you've been working within the limitations imposed by governments. But what the question really is, if it was down to you as ITF and ICS to sit in a room and decide, at what point that the risk has been mitigated as far as we can. You know, working with vaccines, are we looking at 100% of seafarers vaccinated? Are we looking at everybody that wants a vaccine vaccinated? Are we looking at risk groups vaccinated? If it was up to you to sit in the room and say, right, this is what we have to achieve, and then we can remove all restrictions, reinstate shore leave, reinstate barrier-free crew changes, and remove restrictions on board, what would that look like, and would you agree?
Thank you. Guy, would you like to leave?
Thank you.
Did you get all of that?
Yeah, I think I got that, David. And I think you just encapsulated in that statement just the sheer complexity of it. So I've got employers ringing me up saying they've got some of the crew will not work with other members of the crew unless they're all vaccinated. They've got real issues of employment law in terms of can they mandate that all their crew get vaccinated. These are hugely complex issues which extend beyond our industry into wider society. Personally, I'm vaccinated and I would encourage anyone to be vaccinated. I've probably had more shots through my seagoing career than I'm sure all of you on the call have done as well. We've all been, you know, so I think, if I'm honest, it's going to be part and parcel of employment on board a ship. I think there's going to be that, you know, if you want, you know, same as if you're going to travel, you could have a yellow fever vaccination, it's going to be the same with the COVID vaccination. I think in terms of shore leave, again, you've really hit the nail on the head. It's easier just to not allow it to happen than to actually work and put it into a risk controlled process to do it. I think it's the knee-jerk reaction is the computer says no. Rather than, well, how can we make this work? And I think as we move into this next phase when we're having to learn to live with the virus, we're going to have to challenge that a lot more, because we all know that shore leave is good for your mental health. Being cooped on board a ship for a month on end is not good. If you can just go for a walk, and there's simple things in life like going to visit a supermarket and just getting some supplies, the things that we take for granted, is something we have to work with authorities now and try and persuade them. But the vaccination issue is a very complex one, and you know, we've issued good guidance and advice. We've explained the benefits and tried to get rid of some of the myths of vaccines, because there's a lot of myths going about that. But ultimately, I suspect moving forward, there will be a situation where if you want a job at sea, you'll have to be vaccinated. That's my opinion. Yeah.
Steve.
So well, I think I echo most of what Guy said. I think, Andrew, we've had the same problem about coming to an ITF meeting. I've got people saying if they're not vaccinated, you can't let them come in. So we're going to have to deal with this. And I think dealing with it is a reality. I think we were only discussing last week to do some promotional videos in the Philippines and other countries about dispelling the myths, but not Steve Cotton and Guy Patton, but especially Filipino masters. So there might be one to volunteer on here to actually tell other seafarers why you're having the vaccine, because I think education is part of all of these challenges. On the question of mandatory, very tense issue, not just in maritime, but across all of the modes, I happen to agree with Guy personally that in the end, and I believe it's happening in the States as we speak, that it's becoming mandatory to now they've got now the drugs have got full approval. It started with temporary approval for US military, and then they were compelled to have it. And I know there's been some US let's call it litigation. I think in an ordered world, and we go right back to the beginning of the conversation, we need the World Health Organization to make clear decisions, and then we need governments to make the decision so that it's not one individual company fighting with the ITF or Nautilus or any one of you in respect of yourselves, but actually there's a clarity about the decision. Because if everybody makes a decision, then we know what we're dealing with. If every company decides, I'm going to make it mandatory, but another company isn't, how do we then convince the shore states to allow shore leave? And ultimately, this is the bit which we've dabbled with, and we use a lot in AMASUP. AMASUP is like represented here by one of our colleagues, has hospitals throughout the Philippines, and they did the trial first PCR test. So when in the sort of, let's say, June last year, there were a lot of fraudulent certificates about you've been tested. And there was, again, some people from every walk of maritime life not quite representing it properly. So we put in place the testing equipment, and we had a conversation with a QR data entry thing, and we've got QR codes that can prove you've had a bona fide PCR test that could not have been corrupted. And ultimately, in 2021, and we talk about the future of work, which we didn't even get time to discuss here, we must be able to find a digital solution that doesn't put people out of work, but that is part of a solution that will be respected by governments. And if you've had the approved vaccines, WHO, get them approved quickly, and you can prove that you had a PCR test at a recent time or an accurate antigen test that can register, then why can't you let seafarers come aboard, come off the ship? Because we won't go back to that previous question of making job opportunities for young people who, let's be fair, irrespective of where they fit in the world, like the freedoms that technology and other things give you.
Yeah.
So, for us, more work to be done.
Thank you.